The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, Expanse fans, welcome back to The Churn. This week, we're going to be breaking down Triple Point. I'm Cher Martinetti.
And I'm Adam Swiderski.
And joining us, per usual, we have the creators of the Expanse series, Ty and Daniel. Say hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Never gets old.
No, it's a running gag at this point. Every time you say it, it's funnier. Every time we say it, it's funnier. When you say it, it's just the same.
So, Ty is somewhere, but he's just not being vocal because I'm back this week. So, Adam, what do you think of this episode?
Man, the S is really starting to hit the fan for real. I feel like we're getting into the meat now of the season. Not that there wasn't a lot happening before, but it's like
nothing's happened up to this point.
Right, pretty much. No, but we're kind of boiling down now to the flashpoint of all of this buildup that we've had. And it was exciting, man. There's a lot going on. All space this week. We didn't get to see the UN at all. And that's cool because there's so much else to see. I was incredibly frustrated with the fact the thaw with Holden and Naomi continues, but man, are they drawing it out. I have here in my notes, oh, come on, no kissing, WTF. Because there was a moment in this episode where I was sure that Nolden was going to be back on in full force, and it was a tease. So hopefully that's still to come. But a lot of cool stuff, all centering in on Io. The Agatha King had its big moment. And there's some cool science stuff in here, too, that I want to get to talking about later. So, yeah, man, it's all happening, you know? What was your reaction?
I liked the episode. I like that it's obviously setting up for, you know, a whole shitstorm is about to come, which kind of seems to be the theme for this season.
Yeah.
I disagree about the Naomi and Holden kissing. I don't think considering what's gone on between them, I don't think it just, if it was resolved like that quickly, we're like, okay, let's kiss. Like, no, it's like too, I feel like it's too soon. You know, I feel like this is the right normal pace considering they're talking about some really heavy, serious stuff here. And I just feel like if they had kissed, it would have been like, that's just something that would happen on TV. Like, I feel like this is more realistic.
You are absolutely right. It's more just my own personal inner.
That you're being a hornball. Yeah, no, I get it.
Pretty much.
That you're shipping them. I get it.
It's not a horniness. It's that I want love. I want love. I need love. You know, like Kanye. I want the world to experience.
Yeah, don't. Love. We're not name checking that person. So. But yeah, no. I mean, I you know, it's interesting because like just when you think like one person is like the most rotten, awful person, like someone else is like, hold my beer.
That's true.
And I feel like that's happening quite a bit. I don't know. Like I'm a little anxious. I'm a little anxious for next episode, to be honest with you.
I feel like I'm starting to see a pattern now where if there is a character who has generally been bad and we're given a moment to think that they are actually not so bad after all, and maybe have some humanity, that's going to turn out to be a lie because
are you talking about Avassarala by any chance?
No. I'm talking about Jules Pierre Mao this time.
Yeah. He's awful. He's a rotten human being.
I mean, because we had that moment, oh, he's bonding with May and maybe he's actually, you know, he's got a heart. Nope. You know, his ambitions outstrip his any actual empathy he might have. So,
yeah, he's Thanos. He is Thanos.
Much like Aaron Wright, You know, we had this moment of like, oh, maybe, you know, he can be a little sympathetic. Maybe he's going to turn around. Nope. He's a monster. So, you know, that was a bummer.
Monster's going to monster.
That's true. That's true. But yeah, and Avasarala's revelation on the proto-molecule and her true intentions. You know, it's interesting because I did not expect her to actually get to Holden with that. I thought for sure he would be like, you know what? You're crazy. I'm not doing it, whatever. And by the end of that conversation, it kind of felt like she'd gotten to him a little bit, which I was not expecting.
You felt Avasarala got to Holden?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, when she was like, you know, grow up, it's like he, you know, he didn't flip her the bird and say, no, you grow up, you know, which is kind of what I was expecting. So, I mean, I should expect that from Avasarala because that's what she does. She's got the silver tongue, you know, when it comes to this stuff. So that was an interesting conversation that did not go in the direction that I expected it to.
Okay, so how you know, being that you have read the books, how right now has this, what's happened in this episode playing out as opposed to what you've read in the books?
Oh, well, I mean, it's very, I mean, we're seeing
like how you, like, I mean, wait, hold on, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. As a book reader, how what you perceived this to be, like what you thought this would look like.
Well, we didn't get a lot of, in the books, as we've talked about before, because they all take place from, you know, certain characters' POVs each chapter, we didn't get a lot of this, the mutiny and all the stuff that's happening on the Agatha King and the drama there from a first-person perspective. So to see all that unfold was really exciting. I feel like I really like the way this season that they're kind of expanding on what's in the books. And you know, the general plot is still the same, but we're getting so much more context and so much more story out of it, which I think is really cool.
So Ty and Danielle, were either of you on set for this episode?
Off and on. I was with the production every day of photography for this season.
What part of the episode did you guys really appreciate the most or like the most?
The thing that I loved about this episode, I have been very vocal that this is one of my favorite episodes of the series. And the thing that I love about it is having military professional people on both sides of the conflict in the AO, you know, in the shit, facing each other down and looking for some way not to fight, looking for some way to have things not go pear-shaped on them. That it's something I haven't seen very often, and that just seems so authentic and humane to me. I don't know if that's the right word, but it was a view of war that I'm glad we got to put out. I'm glad we got to have that out there. Not just the gung-ho, we're going to go kill, here we go to kill everybody, but, you know, people who are in the field who've been there long enough, who are actually trained military, who've studied, who are prepared for this, look at this and go, oh, this is going to be shit. It would be better if we didn't. If there's some way to not do this, let's not. I love that. I love that part.
Yeah, I particularly enjoyed the performance of, and I, her name escaped me, the captain of the Hammurabi, that both the actor and the character's names escaped me, but I thought she was really great for a character who, you know, is just popping up this episode. I got a lot out of what she had to say and do.
She was really good. I was one of the fun things, I got to help cast her. We had two actresses that were coming in to read for that part, and the director asked me to sit in with him when they did the reading, and afterwards he and I sat and talked about them, and we both agreed that she just had this sort of, she seemed tough, but she also kind of had this weariness and this, I don't know what the word that I'm looking for is, this sort of empathy that radiated out of her that we felt was really good for this part. And then once we actually got to see her on camera and on film, definitely felt like we made the right choice. She was great.
And it was also an interesting episode because we spent so much time with these ships that we don't normally see. I mean, the Hammurabi and the Agatha King are not the big hero ships for the show, but we got to be in there and we got to understand what's going on with them, and we got to have this other little drama that I felt like really fleshed out the world and really expanded the scope of the story for the season.
Yeah, the Agatha King stuff was really exciting, I thought.
Right.
And given how little time, you know, overall we spent with these characters and this crew, I mean, we've seen Souther before, but, you know, just in general, and his crew and his command team, the amount of attachment I felt to those characters almost instantly was really cool. I thought it was like, okay, it's almost like I've been on board with them the whole time, you know?
And I thought that what we did with explaining why Admiral Wynn is what he is was a good note. I thought that was a good place to talk about why he is the hawk that he is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's always nice to get that moment where it's not like, oh, and this person is just an asshole for no reason. You know, he's got his reasons, even if we might not necessarily agree with the outcome.
Yeah. Oh, I like it when we complicate things. I thought this was a really complicated episode.
I have a question about the Agatha King. Has Cotillard just been sitting in that chair for like 3 weeks? Because there's really nothing else in that room.
I'm sure they let him out to go to the bathroom.
I got a kick out of that. It's like every time someone comes in the room, he's just chilling in that chair. I don't know if he's strapped down or...
Well, he's also still got, you know, like a bullet wound. So they're probably still
that's true.
Fixing that. He did get shot in the stomach. And then
that's fair.
And then was very badly patched up by Vasarala, who was not a medical.
No, that was not good.
So I want to talk about one of the exciting things I saw on this episode, which is a breaking burn. That was like, it's, you know, we've had many, many in pop culture, in movies and TV, shots of ships with their engines blasting full bore. And I love the shot, and I can't remember whether it was the Agatha King or the Hammurabi, where it basically pans up from the engines, and then you realize that it's flying in the directions its engines are pointed, and that the ship is actually doing that to slow down. And that was something I don't think I've ever seen in another science fiction franchise. So that was really, really cool. It's one of those cool Expanse science moments, I thought.
We actually do that a lot. It's easy to miss, but when we show ships arriving someplace, they're almost always arriving engine first.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and the thing that we did in this episode that probably drew attention to it is you have the Hammurabi and the Agatha King both decelerating toward Io, and both of them are adjusting their deceleration burn to change when they're going to arrive. You know, the captain of the Hammurabi increases her deceleration burn so that she arrives much later. I think he lowers his deceleration burn so he'll arrive much sooner. So they're both like juggling how fast they're burning the engines to change when they're going to arrive at Io.
And the thing with all of that is that you're balancing on that when you're having the worst burn. I mean, if you have a very short braking burn, it's a really high G burn, and it'll hurt a lot. And if it's a really slow burn, you're doing, you know, maybe a third of a G, you can do it for a much longer time and then not have that punishing moment at the end. The trade-offs on this are not something we spend a lot of time going over in great detail in the show because they're, you know, it's kind of a boring conversation, but it's cool to look at and kind of plan the architecture of the movements around.
And it was just an interesting moment of my brain adjusting, you know. I'm so used to seeing the other thing, you know, the Star Destroyer shot where the ship is just burning its engines and going in one direction. So it took a moment for me to kind of for it to click as to what was happening.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing with Star Destroyers though is if their engines turn off, the ship stops, which is another thing we don't do.
Yes, we do not have ether in our in the Expanse. There's not a substrate in which everybody is flying between stars or planets or whatever.
Okay, so that, I'm sorry, I just had to geek. I'm sorry, Cher, I just kind of dominated that because I had to geek out over the
science. No, it's fine. I was trying to talk and you just kind of talked over me and kept going. That's okay.
I didn't hear you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What were you saying?
It's totally fine. Oh, I don't remember.
Clearly,
it doesn't even matter because it was like seriously 10 minutes ago, so it's not that big of a deal. But yeah, you can actually keep going because I am trying to track down. I'm talking to PR right now, trying to track down Dom. So you could keep doing that while I try to get her.
So how's the weather for you guys? And no, I'm just kidding. So yeah, let's talk about the drama on the Agatha King, because that was a huge central part of this episode. And again, something that, if I remember correctly, is not in the books, right?
It's not something we get to see happening in the books because we don't have anybody on the Agatha King or on any of the airships when that's happening. But the idea of having a battle where there's Earth forces and there's Martian forces and there's within the Earth forces, there's the people who are schismatic with Avasarala and the people who are with Ehrenreich, and then on the Martian forces, there's confusion too, and nobody really knows what relationship they have with any of the other ships. There's the battle lines, but then there's all of the factional work within the battle lines and alliances that may or may not be there across battle lines, and you know, having that be messy was absolutely something we were reaching for in the books. And I think it's something we got here too.
Yeah. And just the ebb and flow of it that happened over the course of the episode. Cause I mean, man, as soon as you think that, you know, the good guys are going to win, that rug gets pulled out from under you pretty quickly.
I'm going to miss old Admiral Sather there. He was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, do you want to talk a bit about that? I guess that actor and his performance and kind of that character, why he kind of became the central character in this drama, other than obviously his connection to Avasarala?
Oh, I mean, we definitely like that actor a great deal. Daniel and I got to write a script. Was that the first or second season where he steps down? That was second season, right? He steps down as fleet commander.
Yeah, no, he stepped down.
Because that's Cutter, isn't it? Yeah, we got to write a script in the second season that was where he sat in a bar with Avasarala and talked about Fred Johnson.
Right.
And he got to really confront her. And just everybody really liked what he did with that scene. He had been sort of playing the straight-laced military commander before that, but he really got to flex and show some of his range. So we were excited to bring him back and give him more stuff to do. And playing on his past relationship with Avasarala is a lot of fun. I mean, they were not friends. When they parted in that bar, they were not friends. He basically called her a snake in a sari, as I recall. But he also knows that she's not a traitor. He knows that she's not the person who's going to sell out to Mars and betray Earth. So he's in this weird position where he's actually having to champion somebody he can't stand because he knows philosophically they're on the same side in this disagreement. And it's always fun to play that, where it's, you know, the uneasy allies is always fun to play.
Well, and it was, you know, going back to season one, he was always the one who was straightforward and saying what he believed and standing by his principles, and that's why he got kicked out of the room. And Avasarala was the one who was there playing the game. And this is the part where we kind of see the logical conclusion of the arc that he started way back at the beginning. And it's an admirable character. It's great to have some of those folks who are in here who are good people doing their level best.
And it kind of just goes to show how hard it is for someone like that, like you said, a good person doing their level best, to exist in a world of all this intrigue and, you know, political wrangling and subterfuge, and survive and kind of get the good things done. So that was a bit sobering, but I should give a shout out. The actor's name is Martin Roach, who plays Souther. He's very, very good.
Yeah, he was excellent.
Did you guys draw? I mean, obviously the, you know, when I think of the mutiny scene on here, you know, I think of movies like Crimson Tide or other movies like that, that kind of had this contained space where you've got this ideological and physical confrontation happening. Do you guys draw on any influences for that, for this episode?
I don't recall anything that we specifically referenced when we were building this.
Not really. We've always talked about in the room, we've always talked about ships in the Expanse being more like submarines. So I'm sure
some of that comes in.
Yeah, some of that comes in. Because, I mean, at least subconsciously, you know, all the submarine movies you've seen will influence how you write some of those scenes. But it's the same kind of thing where you're inside of this bubble of air that is surrounded by death. You know, submarines deep underwater and out of the air ships out in space. So if there's a problem inside the ship, there is literally nowhere to go. You have to solve the problem inside the ship.
And did we ever establish on the show, I can't remember, it's been a while, about what type of projectiles are used for guns on the ship so that they won't pierce the hull or something like that?
Well,
we can talk about
that. Yeah, but we have talked about that, and we've talked about, you know, in the books we've talked about, you know, composite rounds, like plastic rounds that will just sort of splinter into pieces when they hit metal, but, you know, are lethal against flesh. But the reality is the ships in the Expanse, especially the warships, like something like the Agatha King, which are armored and all that, even a regular bullet's not going through that hull.
They're built to withstand micrometeorites, and those are going way faster than a bullet.
Yeah, so
that's a fair point, yeah.
So, I mean, really the reason you would use the plastic rounds is not so it doesn't puncture the hull. It's so that you don't break something inside the ship that you need.
Yeah.
You know, you don't break like a control panel or sever some wiring that's important.
The thing that actually cycles the air, you would like that to keep working.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, I have defeated you and now I will die. That's not a good win. That's a bad win.
Yeah. So it's less about not poking holes in the hull and much more about just not breaking stuff inside the ship.
Not to say we don't just break a whole bunch of stuff inside that ship.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. All of these ships in the battles are going to wind up tested that way. And we've seen that. You know, we saw that before with the Rossi in the previous battles that she's been in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of the joy of the way we put the ships together in this is that when you get in a battle, you get broken. You know, things get holes in them. You got to replace them.
But also, I think what's cool is that you don't get the, oh, we've been hit once and the ship explodes moment either. You know, it's like a ship can really take a beating on the Expanse.
Depends on what it gets hit by.
Yeah, if you hit the thing that controls the magnetic bottle, then yeah, it was one shot and kaboom. But
yeah, and you know, if a bunch of PDC rounds go through your ship, yeah, it'll just make a bunch of holes. If you get hit by a nuclear torpedo, then it is one hit.
Yeah, and then that's unpleasant for you.
I think there's a... forgive me, 5 and 6 sort of mixed together in my head, but I think there's a moment in episode 5 where some ships in the fleet start firing on the Agatha King, and we see the Agatha King shooting the torpedoes down with its PDCs.
I think that's in 6.
Is that in 6?
I think that comes in. Eh, I don't know.
Oh my God, spoilers. Now they know that PDCs get fired. Oh my God.
Yeah, couldn't see that coming.
Yeah, those two episodes kind of...
No, because everybody who was thinking that in 6 everybody would stand down and talk it out,
right,
they're going to be disappointed now.
Yeah.
And we biffed that.
Never mind.
I felt like Gwen was just right on the verge of you know,
of
just being like, you know what, I'm wrong, and we can all...
Perhaps
all
we should reconsider.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the Agatha King and the Hammurabi. A lot of drama there, but you know, a lot of stuff going on with the Rossi crew this week, and we can certainly dive back into that. I feel like it's a bummer that we didn't know this was going to happen when we had Kaz on last week, because we got another view into his family life. Alex's family life with the message from his son.
Yep.
This week, which was another little heartbreaking personal moment for Alex.
Yeah, Alex's son not understanding who his father is yet. That's okay. It'll all the kid will hit adolescence, go to college. It'll all become clear that daddy has feet of clay. It'll be fine.
I was going to say, Cher, how was your reaction to that particular moment?
I was actually waiting to bring this up, so I'm glad that you guys brought it up. I mean, the kid's a better kid than he deserves. It really was my reaction to it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where kids, you know, they don't see their they see their parents as idealized versions of what they really are, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, I definitely, like, listen, like, I think the kid's a better kid than he deserves. I think, like, to show that level of maturity is amazing. But I also think that so far in the show, the kids of the parents tend to be better than the parents in a lot of the instances, with the exception of Prax. I would say Prax is, you know, he's probably the only decent parental unit we've seen so far in the entire series.
Although, I mean, Prax is going down a dark path, man. When even Amos is kind of shook.
I think Anna seems like a good mom.
Anna and her wife seemed like good moms. Yeah.
So far, don't worry. They'll totally disappoint.
Yeah, but I mean, well, that's what I'm going to say. Like, there hasn't been much yet established, so I can't really comment on the type of parental units that they are.
How about obviously shitty? I think if you just not obviously shitty, yeah. that's the win position we're aiming for, right, with the parenting on The Expanse.
Right. I mean, except for, I would say that, you know, now that we get a little more information about, excuse me, Naomi and what happened with her son, I think that's an entirely different case, because it sounds like her ex basically, like, stole her kid and was like, go fuck yourself. And she was put in a position where she couldn't do anything about that. So, which kind of just reinforces that even in the future, even in space, men are still awful. So, but yeah, yeah, so as far as, like, the whole Alex thing, I think that was more than he deserved, you know? Like, I don't know. That was my take on that whole situation. But I want to go back to, like, what you were saying earlier about how, like, seeing this side of war, which, you know, we've said previously on other episodes where this show is, like, oddly prescient, because a lot of the stuff that is coming up just happens to be matching a lot of what's happening in the world right now. And you expressing the desire and being happy that you were able to show this side of war that a lot of people probably don't often get to consider or see, or maybe we don't really get to see in media or in pop culture. And it's just interesting how it's like that, wanting to show that side, and then just thinking about, like, the shit that's going on in the world right now, where it's like, oh, there's really people out there that, like, they don't want to go to war. So I think it's a really important message right now for people to realize, like, not everybody really, like, wants to go to war. Like, it's, the cost is a lot higher than a lot of people make it seem like it is.
And the people who really are often the largest proponents of military solutions are the guys who don't have to go.
Right. They're most removed. Yeah.
And often people who never served.
Yeah.
You know, they, right. you in our current political climate, some of the biggest hawks, some of the loudest hawks are people who, like,
avoided service,
you know, serving in the military. And now they're, you know, loudly calling for military solutions for everything.
Yeah. My grandfather was, a paratrooper in the Pacific in World War II, and came out of that with very strong ideas about how much you should try to avoid exactly that sort of thing. It's harder to be romantic about it, I think, when you've actually had the experience. It's really easy to be very kind of masculinist and over the top when you don't actually have any skin in the game.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what you really hope for, I think, out of your military leaders, is people who, you know, understand the stakes, and that while war is sometimes necessary, I guess, is not preferable. You know, it's not the preferred state of affairs.
Yeah, if you're going to war, it means somebody somewhere along the line has screwed up badly.
Yeah, that whole drama, man. And it's just it's the other interesting thing, I think, too, is that this show is doing really well, is kind of, while this is a shooting war, you know, in some sense, it doesn't feel like the levels of escalation that are happening, it doesn't feel like we're fully an all out, you know, combat at this point, or all out conflict. I don't know. It's I guess probably maybe that is partially because of the vast distances involved.
Well, we're also just shot a doomsday weapon at Mars, and we're about to slaughter an entire planet. So just, you know, put that in there too.
That's a good point. The pods were shot.
The protomolecule hybrids?
They were shot at Mars.
Yeah, no, we're about to wipe out a planet.
Oh, I thought they were shot at the ships of the fleet. Was it said somewhere in the episode that they were shot at Mars itself?
Yeah, if not, we'll find out soon. But that it was certainly my assumption that, I mean, yeah, no, we're that was always a weapon to end the war. One way or another, this is about to be over.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I thought the ending was dark because of the launch. I didn't realize it was that dark. My God.
Yeah, I would not have assumed that that was going for a local battle.
So one of the things that I want to also talk about is Bobby and Alex's brief moment when Bobby was getting her suit together. And she seemed for a moment that even though she like knows what the plan is, that like she might have her own plan. And it caused some pause and concern for Alex. So am I just inferring something or reading into something that didn't exist? Or is that something we're going to have an answer to maybe next episode?
Well, certainly you're going to see where Bobby winds up. But I don't think you can. I think the idea that she lost her fire team to the hybrid and is now over that and in a place of emotional poise and calm seems unlikely, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I would think that she was in a place of emotional poise and calm.
Yeah, I think she, I mean, if I can certainly imagine her being out for vengeance.
Right. Well, that's kind of how I take it, that she learned that they were able to kill a hybrid, and now she's like, then I'm going to go fucking kill a hybrid.
And the other thing, I mean, I think that's, we see a parallel for that with Prax as well, because he's kind of at the emotional point of wanting vengeance more than he, well, I guess he probably thinks May's dead already. So he's just at the point of wanting vengeance more than he wants to actually, you know, act rationally and pursue the larger objective.
I can also see in Prax's point of view that there's two issues here. Save your daughter and destroy the people who hurt her. And really, I can see wanting both. There's room in there for more than one objective. You know, save May if you can. And regardless, light Mao and Strickland on fire.
I want to jump back a little bit because I want to bring up some questions that I'm seeing on Reddit from some fans. And one fan asked this question, how back in way earlier episode that a Martian interrogator said to Holden that Naomi is the best liar by far. So do you think now, like we're further down the line in the story, do you think that that assessment really held any water? Like, is Naomi proving to really be the best liar out of the group? Or,
well, do you think there's anybody else in there who's a good liar? I mean, I think you could play poker against Holden and Alex anytime and clean them out.
Oh yeah, I mean, well, Amos, I don't know, doesn't because lie. Alex,
Amos is
Alex kept the fact that he's a family under wraps. That is lying by omission.
Alex tried to keep the family under wraps, and Amos called him on it in season one and told him it was bullshit.
What do you mean kept it under wraps? He stuck that picture of them on every console he worked on.
No, I mean under wraps that, like, they don't know that he's not.
Yeah. If by lying you mean Alex was capable of not picking up the phone for two seasons, yeah.
Right.
He was good at that. But that's not like it's trying to deceive anybody face to face.
Okay. I think Amos could be a good liar if he wanted to be a good liar.
Oh, sure.
I don't think Amos wants to be a good liar. I think that if he had was like decided he was going to lie, then I think he would be the best liar out of the group.
I don't think Amos would ever understand why he would need to lie. I don't think Amos has anything that he feels like he needs to
lie about.
Yeah.
He's kind of sort of curated his lifestyle where he's not really big into deception.
If he's doing stuff, he's just doing it. He doesn't care. He's not exactly worried about other people's moral judgments.
No.
So, and the interesting thing with Naomi, I think, this is an accelerated revelation of her son and his name and everything, right? If I remember from the books, that she had a family, that she had a son, yes, but not like his name and kind of the background story there. Is that correct?
Yeah.
No, that came in book five. The groundwork for it was in there in the earlier books, but that part of the story didn't hit until later. And we've pulled parts of that story in as early as season one back on Eros. And in fact, during the fight on the Doniger, we made some reference to it too. We've been putting in bits of that story for a long time.
I'm just really curious how far that's going to go this season in particular, because, you know, as book readers know, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to Naomi's past and her family. So are we going to accelerate that even more and touch it? I mean, obviously, I guess that's probably a big spoiler.
That
so
would be
say.
Telling. But I would say one of the advantages to doing it the way that we're approaching it here is should that ever come up and be a critical factor, you'll already know beforehand what the backstory was, and we don't have to like stop the action, go back and talk about it. So
you don't want to have like a whole flashback episode or anything?
I don't. I think not. I think perhaps that would be better served in other ways.
So are we going to get, because I know like I've seen people allude to the fact that Alex and Bobby end up having like more of a friendship in the books. Are we going to see any of that this season, or is it still going to be this kind of like?
I think you've already seen them be friends. I mean, I think that the initial animosity between them has already faded.
So it was funny because when Alex first appears in this episode, you know, he's wincing as he's walking up the stairs, up the ladder into his pilot position or into the comms chair. And my first thought before I remembered that he got his ass kicked last week was that he was sore because he had been working out with Bobby. because she said that they wanted to get rid of that gut. So, you know.
There's room.
Probably a combination of the two.
Yeah, there's room for two things.
Both things can be true.
Yes, yes. But I do want to talk a bit about the Naomi Holden moment. Because I, while the fan person in me, again, you know, wanted the full Nolden in effect, I do agree with Cher that was a really... The whole arc of their reconciliation this season, I feel like, has been a really mature depiction of how these things tend to go, you know, that it's not just an instantaneous flip a switch and everything's okay.
I'm curious to see what you guys think as we move forward with this. There's a kind of relationship redemption story where there's a transgression against the relationship, and then there's forgiveness for the transgression against the relationship, and that's the end of the story. that has never been my experience in the real world. And I'll just speak for myself here, but it's always been there's a transgression against the relationship, and then there's an agreement to talk about that transgression against the relationship, and then there is whatever fed into that original transgression. And if you don't get to that third part, that third level, it's not fixed. It's not cooked. You haven't repaired it, because whatever it was that drove that first disruption is still there. And I'll probably get back to this when we get to call-outs. There's a podcast I listen to that's about couples therapy. And one of the things that they say there is the victim of an infidelity is not always the victim of the marriage. What drove Naomi to do what she did isn't something that Holden can just say, oh, well, you did a bad thing, but I forgive you and I love you anyway.
Right.
That makes the whole arc about whether or not Holden can find it in his heart to forgive her for having been a bad person. And really what Naomi's doing is way more interesting than that.
Like I said before, like, I think it's more honest too. Like, I think that when you're dealing with something, especially when you're dealing with the person that you're in a relationship with, and when they lie to you on a level like she has, even though she had really valid, sound reasons for doing what she did, I don't think that you could just be like, okay, you know, it's like, this is too big of a thing because the stakes are entirely too high. But I think also her saying, like, you know what, I should have talked to you about it, but then understanding why she was hesitant to talk to him about it. So I think it's like it's not just a development like of him as a character, but I think you're learning more about her. You know, you're learning more about like why she is a little bit more guarded and reserved. And it's because she's been tremendously hurt by somebody she was in love with. And now it's that much harder for her to be able to open up or be vulnerable or feel like she can share things with somebody after like a man that she was in love with stole her child, you know?
And in addition, and that is all absolutely in there. And there's this question about loyalty to her people, to the belt, to the kind of people she came from and is related to and identifies with, and her relationship and loyalty to this family full of people who aren't like her. That's a really complicated position to be in. And that she has been hurt by belters, hurt by an old family, hurt by an old lover, and she has seen what happened on Eros, where it was a genocide against people like her.
Yeah.
What's going on in her head is complicated. It's complex. It's rich.
I was
going
to say complicated is the word I would absolutely use. I mean, and it personalizes it so much. It turns it from this abstract political, you know, I'm a belter and I want the belt to have bargaining power, into a very personal personal stakes.
I want to make sure that my son is a member of a nation that can protect him, even though I can't. Ah! That's complicated.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit, because we got yet another recipe what was it, last week? With that...
Gibble.
Yes, the gibble.
Red kibble.
And the red kibble. So where are these recipes coming from? Like, I know we had lasagna previously because we actually made the lasagna on Fangirls. Got the same tray and everything. So where did this red kibble come from?
You mean the actual recipe for it?
Yeah, like who thought, like whose idea was it, like, this is a food that people are going to eat?
Well, originally that was us, but, you know, what we said was, there's this food and it's called red kibble. And then,
were you just basically like, it's just basically dog food? Like, did you look at dog food and be like, yeah, that's what people are going to eat?
No. I think later we gave a few more details. I think at one point we mentioned that it's made of like fried bean curd in some sort of sauce.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
But, yeah.
Well, but that's actually... I mean, I think the big question here is, so when you guys were going into writing the books and conceiving, what are they going to be eating in space in the future? What kind of research did you do? And, like, how did you come up with even these concepts from the beginning?
Well, I mean, some things are easier to grow in space than others. Yeast is very easy to grow in space as a protein. Mushrooms are easier than other plant, you know, plant life, or easier than plant
life, yeah,
to grow in space. Meat, of course, would be
really
difficult. Even the vat grown meat that we have requires significant sort of like industry, which you probably wouldn't have on a spaceship or a small station. So.
And there was the idea of, you know, when you're poor, you eat cheap stuff. You know, I went through college on ramen. I'm sure that ramen would be a belter sort of food. And so the idea of a cuisine and a body of culinary work that is made for convenience and utility and working with the kinds of things that you can make on a ship that's out in space for months at a time. Red kibble is belter hash. I mean, it's not
strange. Space ramen.
Yeah, it's space ramen. It's the stuff that you make when you are in that environment, and then you make it your own, and you make it.
It
becomes an identifier.
Exactly. You take something that is basically flavorless, like fried bean curd, and you put enough sauce on it that it has a flavor.
And then that is the cuisine of your people.
Yeah, exactly. And so, one thing we did here, didn't mean to interrupt, sure, but one thing that's related to that is, I remember reading a thing about how the astronauts tended to lose their sense of smell and their sense of taste after a long time in zero-G.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the biological reason for that is, but that was a thing that that I read that, you know, the people on the space station, you start to lose
your sense of smell and taste. So belter food is spicy.
So belter food is spicy is one of the ideas, is that, you know, people live in space, they would have made very strong flavored food to compensate for that.
So how much, since obviously Mars is its own independent nation at this point, how much of, like, has Mars started, like, do they have a lot of their own culture now too? Like the belt has this type of food and whatnot. Are we going to see more of that, those type of cultural elements from Martians? Or because I think all that stuff's interesting.
We do see some of that in the books. We do talk about what kinds of foods are popular and what kinds of music is popular and what kinds of culture winds up coming up out of Mars. We don't spend as much time there as we do in the belt and in kind of the stations outside of the inner planets. But yeah, no, we will see some of that. And there is some that's there.
So what is like some stuff that's influenced Martian culture? Like if the belt likes, you know, really bad dubstep music, what is Mars like besides country?
Bhangra.
What is it?
Bhangra.
Yeah. They,
Bhangra?
Yeah. They have the Mars in the books has a strong Indian influence.
Yeah. So a lot of Indian popular and folk music, a lot of
Indian food,
a lot of Indian food,
yeah.
A lot of Chinese.
Yeah.
And then some steakhouses.
Yeah. With, you know, that grown steak.
I do think it's interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like such a weird like juxtaposition. It's like you go from having this Asian and East Asian influences and culture to like steakhouse. Like,
well, and
Western.
That's, the idea is that we took a bunch of East Asian folks who went and colonized Mars and a bunch of Texans who colonized Mars, and then they became together this other thing. I mean, the idea of cultural assimilation without a power differential among them is something that I may be optimistic on our part, but it's something that shows up more than once in the series. These are folks who have been living together for so long that, you know, it's ceased to be a division between them.
They've especially been, because they're in domes, right? They're in a very compressed.
Well, they're mostly in the Mars and the books. They're mostly underground. They're That's mostly what I mean. Living Sorry. In using the regolith there as the shielding from radiation. Cosmic rays and radiation. So that's yeah, it's a constrained environment, and it's a very structured culture. It's a very planned, intentional, focused culture. And the their cultural roots are wide and rich, and they've put them all together and become this new thing that now that's what they are.
I do think it's interesting that Alex is the only southern-accented Martian we've met so far, or at least in this episode, he was the only one that we saw.
That's because he's from Mariner Valley.
Ah, there you go.
It's not a Martian accent, it's a Mariner Valley accent.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. That makes sense.
What would be a Martian accent? Because it doesn't seem like there really is one.
No, what would be an American accent? There's a whole bunch of different ones.
Good. Yeah.
Touche.
Yeah, and there's enough. A lot of different settlements all over
Mars.
Mars, and they were settled by different groups of people.
And they've been progressing separately. I mean, you know, Chicago and New York sound different. There are lots of interchange between those guys.
Are people still immigrating to either Mars or Earth from Mars or Earth?
Like, absolutely. No, we had in the first season, we had the Martian ambassador planning to retire on Mars.
And you had
that's right.
One of Bobby's Marines, his parents had immigrated
yep.
from Earth to Mars.
Yeah, no, the borders in this are still fluid. I mean, people are still moving from place to place there then just the way they are now.
Yeah, and we had, Earthers in the belt and not a lot of belters on Earth, though, I would guess, because of the gravitational issues.
It becomes much more difficult once you have been in zero gravity or in really low gravity for a very long time. Going back down is hard. And that's actually, that ratchet is important.
So then how is it possible that Naomi and Holden and Alex are all able to be on a ship together? Like, because they're all coming from different gravitational
Well,
pulls, right?
In the way that we address this in the books, and I will argue plausibly in the show, is we're not always burning at one G. Right. As long as the thrust that the Rocinante is under isn't so much that it's a problem for a belter, then, you know, there you go. You can have it at any gravity that you want it to be at. If you're constantly going at, you know, four gravities, yeah, everybody's going to get smushed. If you have it constantly going at one gravity, then that's kind of like the gravity torture we saw in the first season. Mm-hmm. If you're constantly going at a quarter of a G, then most people are going to be just fine. We are filming consistently at 1G, which makes it a little bit complicated for us. But
how do your belter actors handle, you know, filming at 1G at all times?
They complain a lot. that we had to get waivers signed. But fortunately, in Canada, they have a relationship with the belt that allows us to use them for the full filming day.
I guess the last big thing I want to touch on, obviously, we ended on Io last week, and obviously the show ended on Io, but I want to talk about the protomolecule of it all and the work. That was a big phrase that got dropped in this episode.
Yep.
The work is close to completion, and what that, I mean, is that, again, I kind of, when we talked about Eros, it hinted at the protomolecules building something or working to put things together in a certain way. But I think this is the first time like that term has been used.
Yeah. Well, this is the first time we've had anybody who was in a position to translate much for the protomolecule. I mean, Julie could have, and she did talk about that some. But yeah, the protomolecule has its own agenda. And has it had its own agenda all the way through? It doesn't think that it's a military weapon. It's busy doing its thing, and people are trying to divert it so that they could use it as a tool for their stuff. But it's got its own gig. It's had its own gig from the beginning.
And soon we will get to see what it is.
And apparently it's getting close to done. So that's kind of awesome.
But yeah, that whole scene with Katoa was really interesting. I love the effects of these new breed of protomolecule hybrids, and kind of I also love the protomolecule hybrid eye view shots that we've got, where you can kind of see through everybody. Can you guys talk about the genesis of that and kind of how it was determined what you would see as a protomolecule hybrid?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that. After we shot those scenes, we're talking about the visual effects and what the protomolecule should see. And I don't remember if it was Noreen or I, one of the two of us, I'll give him credit because he's not here. But one of us said, well, the thing feeds on radiation. What's the strongest sort of radiation source in the human body? And then the answer was the nervous system, which is, you know, giving off electrical impulses as it fires. So we decided that the hybrids would just see the nervous system of anybody that they were looking at in the same way that they would be able to see, you know, a radiation source nearby.
Yeah, and that's not even a stretch. I mean, sharks can do that. So this is – we have a grounding in biology that we already know about that makes that plausible.
Wait a minute. Sharks can see the nervous system?
Yeah, sharks can. Sharks have sensors along. They have a sensor organ along their sides that detects electrical activity in the nervous system of prey. Even if you're there are fish hiding under sand on the ocean floor, the sharks know they're there because they can sense their nervous activity. They can sense their nervous system firing.
This is not helping my phobia at all.
You taste terrible.
Well, that's good. That's a relief.
Shark, no shark wants to eat you. You taste like crap. You'll be fine.
Sharks only eat humans when they mistake them for seals.
No, I know. That's true. But, you know, I do have a nervous system. So now it's even more nervous now that I know that.
Yeah, no, they know where you are. If they don't eat you, it's because they picked not to.
That's good to know. But unlike the protomolecule hybrid, who will just tear you to pieces regardless.
Well, if you're useful. I mean, the thing we always talked about the protomolecule as was the protomolecule looks at organic life as a Lego set. And it's like, oh, I need to find something. I need to find a little two-piece. Where's the little two-piece? Maybe there's a two-piece in this thing's spine. No, guess not. Let's maybe over here in this thing's eyeball. Nope. And then this is going to find the little thing that it needs. And, you know, if it tears you apart to get that, that's cool.
And that we have people who are trying to take that and turn it into a weapon is just the saddest commentary on humanity that I can think of.
I can think of worse.
Well, sure. I mean, that's a fair point. That's a fair point. But it's just sad. It's like, oh, man, like confronted with alien technology, the first thought of these people is let's just see how we can use this to kill each other.
I mean, I got to be honest with you. I'm really not surprised by that.
No, nor I. It's just sad. That's all.
Well, on that note.
And on that note, yeah. Woo!
I break down. Yeah.
Let's do some shout-outs.
Mentioned it earlier. There's the podcast I was talking about that was the couples counseling, marriage counseling sessions that have been made into a podcast. It's called Where Shall We Begin? And it's Esther Perel is the woman who's the therapist who's kind of the center of it. And it's in its second season now as a podcast, and it's endlessly fascinating and rich and complicated. And I've enjoyed the hell out of it, and I think everybody should listen to it and see what they think. You can find that, I think, at Esther Perel, estherperel.com /podcast.
Well, okay. Ty, what's your shout out?
Don't get foot surgery.
Yeah, Ty. Oh, okay. Ty's had a bunch of his foot cut off, and now he's all cranky.
Oh my god!
Wait,
Ty's
what? Shout,
no. Ty's shouting out, not foot surgery. Yeah.
not a lot, just a lot of skin. So you know, basically, like had my foot flayed.
Yeah, foot surgery is not like it takes a long time to recover from it.
Yeah.
That's because in other surgeries, you're not actually walking on the
right.
wound.
Right, like, exactly. I was going to say, like, you need your foot.
Was it Dr. Bruce Bolton that was operating on you?
Yeah, that's what I told Janae. I was like, I have a lot of sympathy for that guy now. was it Theo? Theo, right?
I think so, yeah.
Who gets flayed, yeah.
Yes.
I would say that explains your cheery disposition, but you're always like this. So
I'm going to shout out BattleTech. It's so good. This is a new strategy game, a tactical strategy game with a grand strategy overlay, which is very complicated, but is one of my favorite types of games, XCOM being another example of recent vintage. Based in the BattleTech universe from FASA. It's a game by Harebrained Schemes, and it is so good for someone like me who is into giant robots fighting and into these types of strategy games with where you're fighting actual battles, and then you also have a larger strategic thing to worry about. It's really detailed, and one of the things that I love about it is that in XCOM, especially if you're playing on the higher levels, if you lose a battle or if you get to a situation where you have to pull out, it is bad, and you're probably screwed in the grand scheme. You can try to scramble to catch up, but it's not really going to happen. Unless you're really, really good and really scramble to make some changes, it's not going to happen. BattleTech, there are times where discretion is the better part of valor, and you're like, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm going to lose some money. I'm going to lose this contract, but at the end, it's going to help me in the long run. And I think that makes it much more interesting. It makes some of those decisions a lot harder because you don't know, is this going to save me or is this going to screw me in the long run? And again, as someone who is a huge BattleTech nerd from way back, I didn't really have anybody to play with, but I would just sit around reading BattleTech manuals on my own. That's how big a nerd I was about this. It definitely scratches that itch in particular.
And
so, yeah.
What platform is that? Is that PC or one
PC.
Of the... Okay.
PC. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure Elias Tufexis does voice work on that game.
Awesome.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm positive they guessed because he had one of the developers try to give me a free copy, but I said I was going to buy it anyway.
You know, I will sometimes play games that Elias is on just to kind of hang out with him a little bit,
because
he's like off being like a grown up and doesn't live in my city or anything, but I like him, so I'll get like Mankind Divided and just, you know, play through so that I can hear him talk.
It is weird playing Deus Ex now that
it's right? him, yeah. right? It's kind of, it's you know, useful when I'm lonely.
But I loved Mech Commander. Remember Mech Commander?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
I
absolutely.
Loved that game, so I was excited when this one came out.
Oh, no, this will definitely scratch your itch. It's a little slow in parts and, you know, there are some flaws, but they're already talking about post-release support and all the different DLC and free LC they're going to have, so... So yeah, it's something that I'm going to stick with, and I feel like it's only going to get better from here. Hey, Cher.
Hi.
What are you shouting out this week?
I'm going to shout out Childish Gambino's new video for This Is America.
Holy shit.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Because I can't even count how many times I've watched that video so far. It is just, I mean, it sounds so extra or pretentious maybe, but it is a piece of art, and I feel like everybody, even if you're not a fan of hip-hop or rap or of Childish Gambino, like I think everybody needs to watch this video because it's just the commentary that it makes on so many levels is just amazing. It's just absolutely amazing. So that's what I'm shouting out is Childish Gambino's This Is America video.
I saw my favorite comment on that was I saw someone on Twitter say that Childish Gambino is doing what Kanye thinks he's doing.
Yeah, I
don't even think Kanye thinks he's doing that, because at the end of the day, like, everything Kanye has ever done has really been about making Kanye himself the center of something. Well,
and I think it does us a disservice as a culture to have only the only thing we can compare Childish Gambino to is another black guy.
Right.
I don't think
you can compare what those guys are doing. I don't think it does us a service to compare what those guys are doing. I think those are different projects. I hesitate to compare them even to say that they are different.
I also want to add something that in addition to the video, I think before you watch the video, I think you should watch, everyone should watch Donald Glover's appearance on SNL this weekend and then watch the video, because I think together there's, which I found even more interesting, is first of all, his appearance on SNL, he dragged the shit out of literally everybody. He dragged SNL for not thinking he was good enough to be on SNL, but now that he's big, he can host. He dragged Star Wars for having no black people in Star Wars, even though he's Lando. He still dragged them. He made fun of Migos for being these big famous rappers, but also like not really using their platform and their fame in any way, but kind of mocking them and turning a Migos video into friendos and making them in a therapy session. So he, you know, he dragged Kanye and he dragged kind of like media and society with how we talk about Kanye.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then to cap all that off, because he debuted the song This Is America on SNL in his performance, because it's the first time that I think it's the first time that an actor has also been the musical guest. But he debuted the song there, and then he released the video the following day. I believe he released the video Sunday morning, or was it late Saturday night? But I think it was Sunday morning he released the video. And I think that together, first of all, the video on its own is absolutely amazing. But together, I think the full commentary is that Donald Glover is like very aware of the game that he's playing, and he is playing the game, but he's also telling everyone to fuck off while playing it. And he's also like calling out everything for what it is. Like, he's being a black man and an entertainer in this industry that is receptive to him and he's been making rich off of, but he's also at the same time being like, you're all so fucking hypocritical for the fact that you only give a shit about me because I am a black famous entertainer sing, dance, and act.
Let's broaden your shout out a little bit and just include Atlanta and just say, let's just call it everything that Donald Glover
literally
has
everything
ever
Donald
touched.
Glover does. And
everybody and should watch all of it.
Let's say Hiro Murai is also having a hell of a year. The guy who directed the video.
Right. He also directs Atlanta.
Yeah, he directed a couple episodes of Barry, which everybody's talking about. He directed a lot of Atlanta. He's directed Legion. That guy is crushing it as well.
Thank you for editing my shout out, men. My shout out is still Donald Glover's.
Oh no, I wasn't trying to edit your shout out. I'm just adding.
My shout out is still Donald Glover's This Is America video. But I also think that you should preface it by watching his SNL performance, because I think that the two do kind of play off each other really well. But the video, again, like I said, it's on its own is just a remarkable piece of art. And I don't remember the last time I could ever say that about a music video.
Yeah.
So
watch it multiple times.
Yes.
Because there's so much to unpack.
So on that note, to everybody listening, thank you always listening. You know, please rate us 5 stars, leave us some love on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find us on social media at Sci-Fi Wire. You know, leave some comments, in the post. Tell us what you thought of this episode. And, Ty and Dan, do you want to tell everybody where to find you on Twitter?
We are variously at my handle is @AbrahamHanover, and we have an @JamesSAcorey. And then there's a website that is www.jamessacorey.com that has a newsletter that our publisher is championing for us to keep everybody up to date.
Do not follow James S.A. Corey on Twitter. That guy's a dick.
He is kind of a dick. That's not wrong.
He is kind of a dick, yeah.
That's true.
That's part of it. Is, I guess we can say, charm. Adam, do you want to tell people where to find you?
Sure. People can find me on Twitter and Instagram at RockTheFaces.
And I'm The Sharness on Twitter and Instagram. And we will see you guys next week. Thanks.